these are dark days.
Yeah. It's rough out here.
Things are moving so fast that in show notes, which will like I'll do the night before the episode goes up, we'll add some links to places you can donate on the ground if you would like to support people who are protesting. So many places are getting flooded with like the Minnesota Bail Fund. Like I actually gave to a place called Black Visions, I think. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would say so many places are getting inundated with donations, which is great that then they sort of say, like, how about these other places? Yep. But I do encourage you to support Black Lives Matter and its offshoots. Those are people who have been on the ground in their communities for years, and they know what they need better than probably anybody else. So what we'll do is we'll put some links in show notes that will be sort of the most up to date for when the episode goes live.
Yeah, we'll do our best. I gave last night to the Brooklyn Bail Fund. It's Saturday, the 30th. And last night there were protests all across the country and a lot of people got arrested in New York City. So the Brooklyn Bail Fund was reactivated, but they instantly said, gave names for other places too. So we'll do our best, but we'll link also to some of the national Twitter accounts that are keeping these lists as present as possible.
Right.
But we're doing our best also to stand with people in the streets.
Stay safe.
If you can give, give. I know a lot of people are wondering how they can help. Bail is how you can help.
And there was a great thing I tweeted this morning that I'll add to show notes that was like, if you can't be at protests for whatever reason, here are ways you can support from your home.
Nice.
And I think that those are also really important lists.
And also make sure you're registered to vote. Make sure that if you have paper balloting in as an option in your state and you're concerned about COVID, you're signed up for an absentee ballot. In New York, for example, the end of June is our primary. We're, you know, voting absentee here. But that's the quickest and most effective way to help mitigate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Make sure you're registered to vote and vote these fuckers out.
America, same as it ever was.
Anyway,
welcome to Faded Mates. We're not going to talk about this. We are going to talk about another topic. I think it's always really tricky when you're putting stuff out there into the world. It's like, how do you address it? And I think what we just decided was, like, we'll talk about where you can give money and how you can support. And then if that's all you need from us, you can tune out. And if you would like to hear us talk about romance, then you can stay tuned in.
So let's talk about some romance novels. Let's talk about joy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about joy and happiness. This is Faded Mates. I'm Sarah McLean. I write romance novels and I read romance novels.
I'm Jen Prokop. I'm a romance reader and critic. And we're excited to talk about this week's interstitial topic.
Jen is finally in summer, everyone.
I know.
She finished school yesterday. So she's also kind of like shell-shocked. There's a little, there's a bit of a thousand-yard stare in her eyes. I'm looking at her.
It's weird, too, because I feel like the things I normally do at the end of the school year to sort of celebrate, I can't do.
Yeah, of course.
And there are things that happen at the end of school that I'm really sad to have missed. So I was telling Sarah and Kate this morning in our group text that at my school, the last thing on the last day of school is a middle school assembly. And then when the assembly ends, school is over, and the kids, it's like the running of the bulls. Like, they are dismissed from assembly, and it is the most joyful, happy, like, it's pure, amazing, kinetic middle school energy.
Yeah.
And I just am sad. I'm sad. I sort of was thinking yesterday, like, it's to not have that experience with kids. Just feels like, but that's how the school year ends. I mean, it's awesome.
And is your middle school connected to the high school that these kids will go to? So you're at least not losing.
No, them. I will see a lot of them again. But yeah, it's that moment of like kid joy that it's finally summer.
Yeah.
And it's to experience that like with 300 kids at once is pretty amazing. So yeah, I was just sad. I was sad to miss that.
Yeah, that is a bummer. I think about that with, you know, just in general with us here homeschooling, you know, virtually. I said to Eric the other day, I was like, oh, if New York wanted to do us a solid, they would keep that sort of morning Zoom with the class right through summer. Yeah. Just something to give her, like, to center her. I don't know what we're going to do for summer. Camps are a mess. Like,
it's true. So a friend of mine, I'll put this link in show notes, a friend of mine who worked in summer camps forever is putting together with a friend of hers something called My Camp Box.
Oh, fun.
It's like mycampbox.com, and they will essentially like put together a box that arrives at your house every, like, I think 2 weeks.
I'm signing up.
And it's like essentially art supplies and like activities that they would do at camp. And I was like, that's a pretty good idea. So I will put that link in show notes. I have no idea what their capacity is, but I do know that Susan has worked in camps forever. So even though it's like a startup, I do feel pretty okay about saying, like, if anybody knows what it is parents at home need to keep kids busy, it would be Susan and her friends. So,
I mean, whatever. Who can I pay to get my kid to not be my office all day, every day for the months of July and August. Anyway, so this is a bummer of a beginning.
I know. Sorry, everybody. Well, it's where we are.
But it's also the end of May, and that means summer reading. And that means Jen gets to spend the next 2 months just basically reading romance novels and doing nothing else.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Which is great.
It's a good time of year for me.
That's the dream. That's my goal. I want to be you when I grow up. Today we're talking about a trope that I really love, and it turns out you really don't.
Okay, so why don't you introduce it? And it's not that I don't love it. It's just not my...
When we first talked about this trope, I was like, what about this? And you were like, yeah, let's do it. So anyway, the trope is childhood friends to ultimately lovers. And I'm willing to acknowledge that that trope can go multiple ways. I really like it. It will come as no surprise to anybody when it goes through Now We Don't Speak and I Hate You.
Yeah.
Or perhaps Now We Don't Speak Because You Tried to Kill Me. That works too for me.
Sure.
Now We Don't Speak Because You Tried to Ruin Me. Now We Don't Speak Because You're an Asshole. Literally, any version of that works for me.
I will tell you what I found really worked for me was Now We Don't Speak Because You Left Me Here to Handle This on My Own.
Yeah.
And I found the books that I was drawn to that I have read in this trope were really about, like, loss in the middle. Yes,
I have one of those also. I don't love, I mean, I'm on the record for not loving friends to lovers, but, you know, there's that Naima Simone scoring off the field, which is childhood friends to adult friends to unrequited lovers to lovers. And I just could read that book. That is a book I have reread since we've started quarantine because I just love it so much. But we've talked about it before on the podcast, but.
We have, but I will say too, it's the same way. There's like people talk about like, oh, what is like a movie that if you're channel surfing, you have to stop and watch it?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that book is like the equivalent of that. Like you mention it and I'm like, okay, I guess I need to reread it now.
You know what I love about that book? I love Unrequited Love. And so Unrequited Love is about the only version of Friends to Lovers that I really like can get behind. And you don't see it very often. I think because there's a sort of general modern sense of unrequited. We should do an unrequited love episode, but you don't see it very often.
I think it's really hard to do well.
You guys who listen regularly, don't just like come into the Twitter mentions and like shout about books that aren't great. Like if you have read an unrequited love romance novel. And you really loved, would you tell us on Twitter? Because I really love that trope. And I don't think I've ever written it. I guess Callie and Raul, I guess maybe, but they didn't really love each other. It's not really love. I don't know. I've never really written it, I don't think. But I should, one. And two, I think it is hard because I think you can get in the weeds on, like, obsession. You can get in the weeds on, like, somebody just seeming kind of pathetic.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. One of the things about these tropes, I think the thing that these tropes have in common that make them very difficult to do well is, what is the catalyst for change? Mm. What changes, what tips friends over into being lovers? What tips unrequited over into being into requited?
Yeah.
Right? And I think that that's the part that's really hard. So you have, does this person just seem kind of pathetic? Do they, right, especially if it's a heroine who has an unrequited love?
Yeah, I was just going to say.
I think that's really tricky. I think it's so hard. So
but in that,
there's so many variables, yeah.
So two things while you were just talking. One is, yes, it's a heroine problem often.
And by heroine, I mean lady hero. I don't want to inject you and listen to jazz.
Because she seems inactive. Right? Because she's stuck in this rut of love. I would say someone who does hero unrequited love, probably better than anybody, is Lorraine Heath, who routinely will give you a hero who...
Yeah.
I mean, like waking up with the Duke, for example. Like a hero who has spent his whole life in silent pining. Right? Like,
right.
Won't even acknowledge that he's been pining for this woman, but has clearly been pining for this woman. Like, that's my jam. But Naima does it with a heroine, and the reason why it works is because on page one,
she's like, I'm not doing this anymore.
I can't. It's so toxic. This whole...
And that's something we talk about a lot, right? The right place to start a book.
But this is friends to lovers, and so this is a good question, right? Because... I just arguably have written, well, no, not arguably, have actually written childhood friends, also childhood love to lovers, to adult lovers. And starting in the right place is a real pickle for us.
Of course.
Because how do you show childhood? And, like, how do you prove, like, it's this show don't tell issue, right? Like, it's, you don't want to deliver half a book before, like, while they're children.
Ooh, no.
Because then you're not really reading a romance novel. But you also can't, you can't do it without somehow showing them when they were children.
Okay, there's just so many different problems with the pacing and the plotting and where you begin and how much childhood to have. But also, I think the other part that's really built into the system, too, is how much childhood do you show, but also, and how do you show it, but also how much time apart, right? Like, in the ones I had, there's, like, this time apart, right? Because otherwise it would just be friends to lovers. I think there has to be some missing, some time where they're not together. And I think the other thing about that then is really interesting is, how do you show a character who has changed independent of that person, right? So here's who I was when we were kids. Here's who I am now.
Right?
Okay, this is going to be a little garbled, but I was thinking a lot about it. When I think back on who I was when I was a kid and who I was when I was 15 and who I was when I was 20, one of the things I think about a lot is, like, would 20-year-old me be disappointed in me now? And I guess what I mean by that is, like, we all have such big dreams or aspirations or the kind of people we want to be. And then when you, in a romance, meet up with a person who knew who you were, are they going to be disappointed in you the way you are in yourself?
Well, that's a piece of it. So,
right. That's a piece of it.
I think, you know, we talk so much about how romance, the real core, the gold of romance is the story of characters' identities. This is why, this is where romance flourishes.
Yes.
And the best romance does so much intense, nuanced character work that doesn't necessarily exist. I mean, I know it makes me sound, you know, like I'm a romance purist, but I am. And the reality is like,
same.
I don't really think that you'd be hard-pressed to find, like, literature outside of romance that really does the kind of, like, intense character work that we do.
No, I agree.
Because it's all internal, like the whole conflict of a romance novel for it to work, for it to give us that, like breathless, you know, panicked, chest-tightening feeling, we have to believe that the characters are able to change and have capacity yes. for love, right? And sometimes that, even just seeing that, like seeing that evolution to capacity for love is... That's the challenge of romance, right? And that's why when we talked about IAD in the first season, like, it was all about those heroes kind of breaking open.
We were talking about what books we were going to read, and I was like, I want to talk about Bourne. You, and I don't normally, like, use your books as an example, right? But in this case, I really...
Well, I have lots of stories about Bourne and Penelope, so you can talk about Bourne.
That is a book that really gets at this, like, tension of... We were best friends as children. We parted ways, him in like sort of shame, right? Now she's a spinster. He's come back for his land and she had just wanted their friendship back. But I think the thing that was so heartbreaking when they like in meet the up again is her, yes, in the woods, right? Is she's like, oh my God, my friend is back. And she very quickly comes to understand that he's not interested in that. And then what there's this like default to like, now he's going to know my shame, which is I'm a 27-year-old spinster or whatever. I spent a lot of time thinking about like the people you grow up with are the people who know everything about you.
Yeah.
So then they come back and you're like, am I going to disappoint them? Oh, I don't know. It was so... And that's what I think I need from these stories or the ones I'm drawn to. Because the other one I want to talk about is T.J. Klune's Wolf Song.
So that book that Jen was talking about is called A Rogue by Any Other Name. It's the first book in my Casino series.
Mm-hmm.
And that hero is a lot. Ooh. He's a lot.
Yeah, he is.
He's bitter and angry and vengeful and mean and hurt.
Uh-huh.
And Penelope, his heroine, is hurt by him. I mean, like, she is devastated. Like, they were best friends. And when he returns, he is nothing of the friend that she once had. And, you know, she's also pined for him. I mean, I guess that's the most, like, that's kind of a piney book, too. Like, she's pined for him, but not for, like, she's pined for his friendship, not for his love.
Not for his love, right.
And so when they do fall in love in that book, and it's late in the, I mean, that book is probably the hardest book I ever wrote. He was such a big ship to turn around. It was hard. Mm-hmm. There are probably about 60,000 more words of that book that are not in the book, that are just like chapters that didn't make it in. But the reason why it was so hard to turn him around is because she had to give up the childhood him and like basically put that childhood person to bed and fall for.
Yeah.
Like, probably my most alpha hero. Like, he's so...
Yeah.
He's made of stone.
So I was really thinking, like, in this trope, like, when I remember it, right? Because I literally... So I was telling Sarah at the beginning. I was like, yeah, let's do it. Sounds awesome, I'm sure. I mean, I know this sounds real self-important, but I feel like I've read everything. So I was like, oh, it's just a matter of like reminding myself of which books I've read that are like this. And then I will have things to talk about. That's often how I approach this task. Like, right, we decide on a trope and I decide on books after. And sometimes then I'm like, what have I read? So I go to Goodreads and I look up like childhood friends to lovers, adult romance, and it's 300 books long. And I'm like, I haven't read these or I didn't like them. And I think it's because if it's hard, it has to be hard because you have to let go of who you were and who they were as children in order to move on. Right. That's what I want. I want it to be like, world is on you.
I picked Kennedy Ryan's Queen Move this week because, I mean, I'm on record for thinking Kennedy Ryan is a tremendous writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably, I I could have put this book on a list, on like a let's do a deep dive on this book list. But we're not going to do that. I'm going to talk about it today. But Kennedy, so we talked, briefly at the beginning of the episode about where to start the book. And both of my big picks start, well, all of my picks start in childhood, like in actual childhood. And all of them do very different kinds of work. The first 20%. So Kennedy's, the Queen Move heroine and hero have known each other since they were babies. They're next door neighbors. And the heroine, the hero is half Jewish, half Black, born in Atlanta. And so that comes with, right off the bat, Kennedy talks about loving V. Virginia and like how complicated that life is. Mm-hmm. His mom is the Jewish character, or is Jewish. And she misses New York. She's from New York City. And now she's in Atlanta, and like this is a different world, and also having an interracial relationship in the South at this time is all sort of coded into this, or like not coded, overtly written into this book. The heroine is Black, and so there is this. There's this really like wonderful relationship that builds between these two children. They know each other's insecurities intensely because they've known each other forever. They understand each other's family dynamics in a way that like wouldn't ordinarily happen for older characters if they'd met and had these kinds of relationships. And so there's a very sort of intense, as I was reading it, I was like, it's not a sibling relationship, but like there's this moment where it's like their families are interconnected because they're very good friends, and like there, it's such an emotional community. What Kennedy does in the beginning of this book, for the first 20% of this book, is build this community of people who support these two kids who are both a little bit on the edge, right? Like he's a biracial kid who goes to synagogue, and has to deal with, mm-hmm. his intersection. And she has a stutter, and she's like she grows into this like awkward teenage phase. We know her from the earlier book in the series if you've read The Kingmaker, you know this character. Anyway, so, but for 20% of the book, Kennedy delivers us this kind of beautiful like little bubble of these two kids who love each other, and then they suddenly realize that not only do they love each other, they like feel things for each other. They are each other's first kiss. It's so intense. And then it becomes clear immediately to the readers, but not to them, that his mother and her father have had an affair.
Yikes on bikes.
And then at 13, she lifts her son out of this world, this idyllic little bubble. I mean, that's not really idyllic. Like, they're dealing with kid stuff, bullying and other stuff. But still, they have each other. And she takes him back to New York City. And he's gone until they are in their 30s. And then he returns on the day of her father's funeral to pay his respects. And he's married and he has a child. And
wow.
Suddenly, and she's still single, and all she can really remember is like this boy that she literally looks at him. And then also he has a child now who is old enough that she can tell that, like, she can see him in this child.
Right.
And she's immediately transported back to the person that she loved and the life that they had. Now, of course, she's a political operative. She's a like incredibly powerful campaign manager, and like an incredibly impressive, like a woman who has her own life in this like incredibly impressive way. But what the friends to lovers piece here is about really learning, they have to learn each other again. And of course, he's also married, so that's a
Right.
Whole nother thing. But no, I mean, that there is no infidelity in this book. It's...
Well, only their parents, right?
Yeah. Well, there is infidelity in terms of the parents. But then there's that to deal with, too. Like, how the families... Like, Kennedy writes... You know what I kept thinking as I was reading this book? And I've said this before, I think, about Kennedy. When she writes a book, and this is less true about the long shot, you know, hook shot, block shot books. But these books, these sort of bigger... these kind of dynasty books feel like dynasty. They feel like massive soap opera-y kind of books where, you know, at one point in the early version, in the early pages of the book, we get a whole story from the perspective of his mom. Like, she's fearless in the sense of, like, she breaks a lot of rules of, like, how we should be writing romance. And she's writing kind of really big, meaty stories that also tell these, like, intense emotional stories. And I do think that that's where we are with Friends to Lovers, because the intensity of Friends to Lovers, or childhood friends to adult lovers, however that path goes, is about trying to recapture something that you can't necessarily recapture.
You're trying to recapture that with someone who's different and you're different. But also, I think, and I think about this a lot with Bourne, and I don't know if this is the case in Queen Move. Mm-hmm. Queen Move, is that the is they also know your weak points, right? They know where to apply pressure. And sometimes when that pressure gets applied, it's a move to, like, save yourself, right? Like, I'm in danger, so if I can push this button and push them away, then somehow I will... I won't risk myself. And I find that those then, like, think about falling in love with someone who knows all of your dark secrets and all of your vulnerabilities and exactly how to push those buttons. Like, it's both, but they also know all your secrets, so you don't have to tell them. I mean, right? Like, think about everything that's coded into somebody who knows everything there is to know about your family, all those vulnerabilities, the way you dealt with them. I mean, that's the part that I think is really... So if I can, like, talk about Wolf Song by T.J. Klune. I don't know if you've read this, but this book is... It really blew me away. This is a book that when people recommend books to me, I often will read the sample on Amazon. I don't even, like, send them my Kindle anymore. I just go right to, like, read inside because I'm never sure if I'm really, like, gonna like it. And I am that way. This book swept me away immediately. And it starts off with a boy named Ox. He's 12. His name's Oxnard, and everyone calls him Ox, and his dad is essentially, like, walked out the door. And one of the things I'll tell you is I actually sometimes struggle with too much childhood on the page. I think maybe it's because of my job.
Look, as somebody who's written these books, like, the question of how much childhood to put on the page is a very important one. And it has to be doing the kind of work Kennedy's doing, where she's telling us a bigger story. Like, she's having a conversation about parents, about childhood, about identity, about, like, it can't just be like, here's 5 chapters or 10 chapters of them being in love.
In Bourne's book and Rogue, it's told through letters, right? We get their letters back and forth to each other, and everything else is memory. So this is a very different book for me because it starts off with, now here's the part that's interesting. Ox then is... His dad leaves. He's kind of, like, real young and going to be the man of the house to his mom, who is, you know, devastated and just trying to keep it together. And so we get a couple years of kind of, like, Ox's life in this small Oregon town. And then a family moves in next door and they have a boy who's a couple years younger. I think he's 10 or 11 and Ox is 15 or 16. And this boy is, like, we're best friends. But it's, like, kind of cute, like, in the way that, like, sometimes little kids, like, latch on to older kids. And then what we understand is that Joe's family, they're actually, like, we know kind of instantaneously it takes Ox longer, are werewolves. And Joe has actually been kidnapped by their enemy and has not talked for 2 years. But upon seeing Ox, immediately is like, what's up with you? Why do you smell so good? What's going on? And it's like this amazing scene. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. This book blew me away. It's so good.
That's awesome.
And the thing that's also really, it is awesome, but it's, and I would say, I say this, one of my biggest problems, everyone's biggest problem with the Twilight series is when Jacob imprints on a baby, and it's like really gross in every way. And I'm sorry, I know it's like no kink shaming, but it was really, I was like, we don't need to do this.
Well, wait, we had this. Wait, this happens in a Cressley book. It happens in Declan Chase.
Yeah, and I didn't like it at all. I was like, this is really hard for me, right? I was like, well, because what I liked instead is the vampire thing is, you're not going to imprint till they're essentially of age.
Lothair.
Right? Like, yeah.
Like Camp Blood until Ellie is old enough. Nice work, Cressley.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, good save. But I think a lot of writers post-Twilight had to figure out how to deal with this.
I mean, look, this is definitely on the Simone scale. And it's probably not that far in. It's probably up into weird, but not that far into wrong. Like,
right. Like, how is this? How are you going to really deal with this? If there really are, like, sort of, if there's that kind of work happening, like, what does it mean when it's a child, right? So in this case, what's great about this is Joe is like, he's, yeah, like, we're friends. I'm friends with his family. He's got older brothers. We're all friends. I really fit in with these people. And then what happens is he thinks of Joe as a child until Joe is like, it is a great scene. Joe is like 17 going on 18, and Ox is now, I don't know, 23 or 24. And he's had like lovers and of both sexes. He's bisexual. And he all of a sudden like sees Joe and literally like walks into a wall. Like, right. All of a sudden he's like, this is a great scene, but what happens is the man who's threatened Joe comes back and threatens the family. And Joe and his brothers essentially leave, and they leave Ox to be with his mother, to take care of sort of the people in the pack that are left. And I don't want to get too into it because it's pretty late into the book, but then it's Ox dealing with, I'm in love with you, and now you're gone, and you left me here. You decided to leave me, even though you knew we were in love. And it is a powerhouse of a book. I thought it was so great. The writing is amazing. I think it's doing some really interesting work about like what it means to be a pack and who gets to be invited. But also like this love story between Joe and Ox is all about loss and grieving, because once Joe is like, my job as Alpha is to go take care of, you know, this killer on the loose who threatens all of us. And Ox is like, don't leave me. And it is so powerful, but it is so infused with like loss and longing. And then when Joe does come back, and again, it's like, I don't want to spoil it, but then it's like, your leaving was a betrayal. And I think that those are the books. It's, and even though when Bourne leaves Penelope, she understands why, when he stops writing her back, that's the betrayal,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean,
that's the betrayal. Yeah,
she's, and then it takes her a long time to get to a place where she doesn't write to him anymore, where she's like cleaned herself of him. And then he turns up and she's really happy. She like can't stop herself from going right back to that moment. And he just,
of course,
smacks her down. Oh, God, he's such an asshole.
God.
Anyway, if you like asshole heroes, he's my biggest asshole. Believe it or not, Ewan coming down the pike
is
my biggest asshole.
Mm-hmm. A little competition there in the McLean universe.
No, even with Ewan. No, but it's interesting because I also think friends to lovers can work, or childhood friends to lovers can work with misunderstandings in a much better way. And I think so my other pick, or it's not really my pick, but it's another book I want to talk about. I have two others that I want to talk about, but is Lisa Kleypas's Again the Magic, which I know some of you out there are reading right now or have recently read.
Yeah,
Beth just or just recently read, right? Or a bee in her books.
I think so, and her friend.
So, again, the magic. I'm pretty sure I've probably talked about this before because I don't know if we've ever done a secondary love story interstitial. We really should. But this would have been,
yeah.
This would be the book that I would put first.
It really is true. We'd have to fight over it.
And I'm not actually going to talk about the secondary love story here. I'll just say, like, categorically, this is the best secondary love story ever written in romance, period, and done. Send tweet.
Agree.
But the main love story in this romance is between Aline and McKenna, and McKenna is a stable boy, and Aline is like if for those of you who read the Wallflower series, her brother is Westcliff Marcus, and so she is young, and she and McKenna have this like intense love, like, and it's this intense falling in love, and I've just pulled the book off my shelf to make sure the childhood scenes. End at page 63. And so basically McKenna is like in this, it's so Kleypas. It's so awesomely Kleypas, this whole setup. But basically she's totally in love with him. He's a stable boy. And he's like, I love you too. I'm going to make I'm going to make a life for us. Like, we're going to be together. And her father's like, no fucking way.
Yeah, right. Is like, this happening? No way.
Like, and there is like a kind of big misunderstanding where she ends up sort of sending, she ends up, he basically says, I'll never leave unless you tell me to go. And then there's a fire and she tells him to go. And it comes out way later in the book. So he comes back. He comes back 12 years later and he is pissed. He's gone to America. He's made himself a fortune. And he's back rich and powerful and ready to stick it to her.
Oh, God, I know.
And he is furious. And she's like a spinster. She's an unmarried spinster. And she kind of takes it from him. Like, she's like, okay, you hate me. Like, I got, okay. And you're like, and he just can't deal with how she just like rolls over for it. Like, he had this vision of coming back and like sticking it to her and having her be like fiery and angry, and she's not. And then they sort of start falling back into like, they sort of start remembering why they love each other, why they loved each other from the start. I mean, Aline never forgot why she loved him. And it becomes clear that there had been a terrible kitchen fire and she had been burned horribly on her legs, scarred terribly on her legs. And so she has trouble walking and needs to be careful and needs to be thoughtful about her physical. She doesn't have as much physical ability as other people. And so he can't figure it out. Like, she won't let him touch her below the waist. Like, he can't figure out what is going on. And then it becomes clear that she was so ashamed of, you know, what had happened to her, that she has never fallen. She's never like even gone out into society. And now she feels like less than for him. So this, I suppose this all requires a content warning that like there is sort of ableism in her view of herself in this. But there is no ableism in his view of her. And he is.
Yeah.
So when he finds out, it's like this magnificent scene where he's horrified that he left her in pain. Right. Like, he's it's McGreeve brain a little bit. Right. He's so broken by the idea that she was in pain and he was so stupid and like in his like right. stupid anger place. And he left her, you know, in this terrible place. The point of this is there's like in this place, it's all about the misunderstanding. It's about the like the choices that they made because their frontal lobes were not fully formed. And then it ends up with them sort of having built themselves into these two creatures who are like too stubborn to acknowledge that their childhood, they were kids and stupid. I really like that in books when people are like, I fully buy like mistakes made as children form us as men and women.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's, so I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, like, in every case that this trope has worked for me, it is because of those mistakes were made. And now we have to, like, figure out if we can forgive each other or move on or understand, right? Like, there, it just can't be like, oh yeah, we were in love as kids and now we're in love as adults, because I need that big shot of conflict.
Yeah. And, but, you know, it works for me. Like, so often we say, like, to romance writers, oh, well, a misunderstanding can't work as plot, or, like, it can't just be that, like, the letter never got to her, so, like, your life, like, so you didn't fall in love. But the reality is, and this is also a trick that's useful in historicals, right? Like, that maybe this wouldn't work as well in contemporaries. But, like, in historicals, this can work, right? Like, and it can work so much that, like, McKenna is forged in the fire of his anger. And so, like, and his vow to stick it to this family that didn't believe in him. That when he comes back, he's just, like, watching him unravel that is a joy. And the misunderstanding becomes a really glorious plot. Because, I mean, also, it's in the hands
of Kleypas.
Kleypas, right?
Yeah, right.
So at the same time, there's the writing of Aileen and the real believability that she has convinced everyone in her life to not tell him the truth about that day. When he left.
Yeah.
And everyone is sort of helping her keep the veil down. It's great.
It is great. I love that book.
It would be my favorite Kleypas book, if not for the fact that the secondary love story is so tremendous that I just want that book instead.
Right. I mean, it's like such an embarrassment of riches in that book.
The secondary love story also deserves a content warning, too. The hero there is an alcoholic. But woof, that story is so great.
Yeah, it's really good.
Anyway, do you have another? Because I have another, but...
Well, I think it's another one I've read, so I thought at some point we'd just sort of talk about them together,
yeah.
Right?
Because yeah.
I guess, part of me is like, no, it's weird. I had a hard time. I feel like what's going to happen is people are going to be like, well, what about blah, blah, blah? I'll be like, oh, duh, of course, that one.
I like contemporaries. I like Harlequins, like categories.
Yes.
Where the heroine or the hero return home and yeah. Like they were the nerd and like suddenly yeah. The homecoming king
yeah, that's,
is into them.
Give me like, that.
I mean, as the nerd who had a crush on the homecoming king, like, it feels like it's just me replaying my own, like, you know, high school desires. Like, that one day I would return and I would be, you know, a best-selling author and he would say, it was always you, Sarah.
Sure.
Let me tell you something. I now follow this person on Facebook and it was never me. So, I'm really fine with how it all turned out. But the reality is that that kind of relationship is really, I mean, like, I think for those of us who were not homecoming queen, like, that's a really
yeah.
nice
oh, yeah.
feeling.
I think that's exactly right. Like, these books, if they're too rooted in childhood,
yeah.
It's just like, oh, I lived it. It's okay. Right?
Yeah.
But I'm reading a graphic novel, a middle grade, an MG, like a middle grade graphic novel right now called Fake Blood by Whitney Gardner, where a boy who's like a total nerd, and I actually am going to take a picture of this like one page where he and his two friends are like, they're like, what'd you do all summer? And one girl's like, I bungee jumped. And one girl, I don't know, did something. And he was like, I read like 10 books. I got like the free glasses at the library giveaway. And he is in love with this, like, the cool girl who it turns out is a vampire slayer. And I got to tell you, this book is so cute.
Yay.
It's really cute. I'm like, oh, I read one chapter and I stopped because I was like, I just want to savor this little delicious
yeah.
thing. Like when kids are like, I'm sad, I'm a nerd. That's so real to me. It's so hard. Babies.
I mean, I'm still a nerd and I'm fine.
I know.
That's what you
want
to say to kids, like, who are nerds.
Yes.
Like, that's what I want to say to, like, the kids who are nerds and, like, the kids who feel weird about their bodies and the kids who feel weird about, like, what they're into and the kids
who
have funny teeth and, like, weird hair. Like, I just, kittens, you are going to find your crew.
Yeah, you're going to find your people. Yeah. You know what's hard, though, is as adults, that, like, works, but kids don't want to hear that.
I know. I know they don't.
They're like, no, I am an individual person, and no one understands
me. No
one
has ever lived my truth. Except every other person who has been 15.
They don't want to hear it. So that's what's hard about it. But, you know, there are books about
it. The one thing that I wish I could go back and say to, like, 15-year-old me is like, don't peak too early.
Yeah.
Because it's a long drive home.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. That's a really good point. Okay, so talk about The Highwaymen.
Yeah, so this is just, I just picked three books that I really love that have this trope, and they all actually do it really differently, right? They use it in a different way. You know, Kennedy's book is really about the way that the world manipulates us when we're children. The book is not, but certainly the conflict of the book and certainly the beginning, the setup of this book is about the way the world manipulates children and, like, forces them into whatever world. And Lisa's book is really about, the way that we... the way that our doubts and our fears just build, like, create us and, like, turn us into monsters for ourselves, like people we are afraid of. And Kerrigan's book, The Highwaymen, wow. If you love, like, big, epic, old school romances, and you haven't read Kerrigan Byrne, like, this is a gift. I'm giving you the gift of Kerrigan Byrne.
It really is, like, channeling sort of old school tropes pretty fearlessly, including one where, like, they were childhood best friends and totally in love with each other, and she spends the entire book, like, not recognizing
him. This is that book.
Right? Like, that book's just like, yeah, fuck you. She doesn't recognize him. Go with it.
All right, Jen, here's a test of our friendship. I don't think we've ever talked about this before, but I know that you also had a Val Kilmer thing, so I'm assuming. Were you a fan of The Saint?
Yeah, movie?
Of course, right?
Yeah, of course.
Like, okay, you guys.
All of
the
them.
Saint is a movie. I'm not ashamed.
No,
the Saint is a movie that I can recite pretty much word for word. It is Eric's, I think probably Eric's, like, greatest disappointment in me. Like, it is the thing he had to get over in order to marry me. And it's like, and Val Kilmer playing 45 different people.
Sure. Of course.
It's like my dream. Like, if I ever, like, when I was in high school and college, like, it was Val Kilmer or bust for me. I think I have said that on the podcast. First of all, oh my God. Did you ever read that piece?
Yes.
It was bananas, but also amazing. We're going to put in show notes this wild New York Times feature or profile of Val Kilmer recently, like a couple of...
Sure, like a couple weeks ago. That author is the one who wrote Fleischman Is in Trouble, which I immediately bought
because I was like...
It's a terrific novel.
Her writing.
But she's amazing.
Anyway, there's a profile of Val Kilmer from the New York Times recently, and it's written like... The reporter went out and met with Val Kilmer, like, a week before quarantine started. And so, like, it's this really fascinating, it's just beautifully written. We'll put it in show notes. Go read it. It's worth it. Even if you're not, even if you in high school and college were not like me and obsessed with Val Kilmer and used Val Kilmer as, like, a myriad, like versions of Val Kilmer's name and, like, weird life data as your passwords for way too long. Yeah. You can't break into anything now, because it's not Val Kilmer.
It's Tom Hardy.
No, it's not Tom Hardy either.
That's hilarious.
Anyway, the point is, I was...
Wait, can I interrupt you before you go on your...
On my Val Kilmer,
Your Val Kilmer... Well, I said to Mr. Reed's romance. I was like, this, because he was like, yeah, that picture, like the photo of him, right? He was like, it's really upsetting. I was like, here's what's upsetting about it to me is I was like, it really just shows you how fucked up it is that Tom Cruise has like not aged at all.
I mean, I guess we should all be Scientologists.
Oh, and have a lot of work done. Like, there's no way that man is not, like, completely made of spare parts at this point. But I was like, that's the thing that I think about is, like, when you see contemporaries and one is, like, aging, like, as a regular person and then one isn't.
Well, regular.
Right. Well, I mean, you know.
But you know what's fascinating? And the question that article posed at one point was, like, what a weird thing that Tom Cruise became the superstar and not Val Kilmer, because, like,
right,
look at the two of them. And it's,
yeah.
And I mean, not now, but then. Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Point is, Val Kilmer forever. And and anyway, where am I going with this? Oh, The Saint. So I was obsessed with The Saint. I mean, like, I owned it. I have owned it on multiple formats. I still own it. I don't even think Eric knows this, but I own it digitally and it's on my computer. Like, sure. I love this. I love when he's at the Shelley Monument and then he gets drunk and he falls and there's a cut on his face. I love all of it. I love his weird accents. I love it. Anyway, beginning of The Saint, do not, P.S. if you've never watched The Saint, this is not me endorsing The Saint.
This is like endorsing your id.
A truly terrible movie on the rewatch, but I don't care. This is just my, here we are. I'm opening a vein. I'm pouring out to you guys. Okay. So The Saint begins in an orphanage where, like, a Catholic orphanage where, like, a perfectly modern person. So I don't even know. Like, I don't know where this orphanage is, but they speak English and fine. Catholic orphanage where he is like, it's where two children, a girl and Val Kilmer, are like kind of doing a little like flirty dance at the age of like 10 or 12. Like, it's harmless childhood flirting. Right. And she's pretending to be a damsel in distress and he's pretending to save her. And she falls tragically and dies, like, in this, like, beginning. And I have, and the beginning of The Highwaymen feels this way to me because it begins in an orphanage where this girl and these boys are all, like, it's run by a horrible, terrible priest. And they kill the priest and have to run.
Yeah.
And one of them gets... and then it turns out, like, then it jumps forward, and the heroine works for Scotland Yard.
Yep.
And there is this, like, ruthless, like, scoundrelly,
oh, yeah, you know,
villainous villain, right?
It's like Bond-level villain shit, right?
Yeah, who's been in Newgate prison, and, like, and he comes out, and he is the... Oh, and they marry. Wait, I'm sorry. As children, they, like, get married. They, like, hand fast in a field. Like, it's wild. So she is now in Scotland Yard, and she's, like, presenting herself as a widow. And because she's married. She's like, I'm married. I got married at 12, like, in a field outside an orphanage. It's fine.
It's like daisies in my hair.
It's fine, you guys. Don't worry about it. And then he turns up and they fall in love. But she's like, I can't fall in love with... I mean, like, they fall in love. They start to, like, fall for each other and they definitely have sexy times. And she's like, I can't love you because there was this other boy... Like, I married this other boy, even though she thinks he's dead. And turns out, not dead, totally alive. Switched identities.
Sure.
I mean, you guys, it's, like, probably four bananas on the banana scale. If we're saying, like, Sex Planet is five bananas, it could be five bananas on the historical scale.
I think on the historical scale, it absolutely is five bananas.
It's a five banana book. And it's... really delightful. And then here's the thing. You can read the whole series and ultimately it gets you, like, for the first, like, four books, there's this big question about, like, what happened, like, who the identities are of all these kids. And it really, It's very delightful. It's a very rewarding read. If you love historicals, you've never read Kerrigan, start with The Highwaymen. Just read them in order. They're all like kind of dark and gothic and Victorian. These are not like playful light books. You're not getting like...
Not at all.
These are not read-alikes with like Julia Quinn. These are definitely read-alikes with like Jane Eyre.
I was like, whatever that old school over the top stuff is, that's what it is.
In the family tree of romance, these are on the Jane Eyre branch, not the Jane Austen branch.
Yes.
But they are really, really fun.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a new one out now, maybe next week, called A Dark and Stormy Night with a K. I'm here for it. No, it's not out. It's out it's out Tuesday, June 2nd. So it was out, it was out yesterday. It came out yesterday, June 2nd.
We got there. Can I, this is not related, except it's like perhaps the best text, like Fated Mates related text I ever got from my friend Hannah, who comes to my 57th Street book club, and it's all caps, and it says... James Mallory kidnapping his own wife while pretending he doesn't want her is my new favorite trope.
Yay!
One-handed using his teeth to tie the gag because he was not letting her go. Oh my God. And I was like, fucking romance.
Oh, it's so great. And she hasn't even gotten to the part where he gets bangs.
Fucking romance. It's so perfect.
I know. We're on day 78 here in quarantine. I'd like to convince Eric to get some James Mallory bangs. I'm happy to cut them.
Oh, God.
I tried to convince Eric to let me cut his hair, and he thinks that I wouldn't be good at it. He's like, you know, people are good at cutting hair. And I was like, I'm not denying the fact there are people who are better at cutting hair than me, but I think I could watch a few like videos on YouTube and be able to cut your hair an inch.
Yeah. No,
he doesn't trust me. There's not a lot of trust in our relationship.
Well, that's it. Like, I mean,
I would never let him near me with shears, so it's fine.
My haircut is so, like, it's months overdue for haircut, but it's still, like, shape-wise looks okay. So, like, shout out to Lonnie at Salon 1800, because when you cut my hair all those months ago, you must have really done it.
I just look like a fucking lion. I really do. Like, if I take my hair down, I posted a picture to Instagram yesterday. It's just like it's a mane of like now ombre, like kind of weird.
Oh, yeah.
Ombre.
Mine is definitely a weird color. I feel like there's like a kind of scraggly, like white lady hair thing that happens where it just like lays there real flat and it's bad. And I feel like I'm in that window, but I'm alive, so it's fine.
I mean, there are, yeah, exactly, right?
Right?
Like, if all I have to do is deal with my, like,
my bad
giant
hair
for summer, I'll take it. Anyway, next week, Kingdom of Dreams. I'm going to reiterate my content warning, you guys. A thing happens with a horse early on. Just push right through. Just know when you get there, you're gonna be like, oh my God, I can't believe these bitches suggested this book. And I'm telling you right now in your ear holes, I know. Relax, keep reading.
Keep reading.
Or stop if you're traumatized. But if something terrible happening to a horse is a thing that you think you can't read, consider this your content warning.
Oh, Sarah.
I mean, I'm trying to be nice, but what do you say? All animals are what?
All animals are symbols.
Yeah.
That's my first rule of symbolism. My second rule of symbolism I'll be uncovering later when we have an actual Daring the Duke.
Oh my God. Did I do something symbolic?
I know, you didn't expect it.
Oh, by the way, Daring and the Duke is coming out June 30th. You can all pre-order it now. You can get it from my local independent bookstore, Word, in Brooklyn. And you will get Fated Mates stickers. Unique.
Yeah.
Special edition, one time only, yellow Fated Mates stickers that are really gorgeous. And you also get some other stuff from me. And it'll be signed. And please patronize me.
Just do it.
You know. And then, and that is also childhood, surprising no one, that is childhood friends to lovers to very big enemies to lovers.
Oh, yeah. Big enemies. It's amazing.
Big enemy energy.
Big enemy revenge. I mean, all, like, right? Like, oh, what was the part? Is it the Princess Bride where he's like...
Fencing, fighting, torture, revenge, giants, monsters, chases, escapes, true love, miracles.
Like, he, like, lists all the things in the story.
Oh, I love that part. Hey, here's a question for you. Yes. My daughter is 6 and a half. Would the Princess Bride work for her? Like, I think it's fine. I'm not worried about content. I'm worried about, is it boring?
All you know what? Kids are so different. All you can do is, like, start and then see how it goes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You just got to give it a shot. Because it's like kids are so different at this age. Here's what I will say. I think if you do not, as a parent, go to Common Sense Media... Common Sense Media has movie reviews, but the thing that is, like, most useful, because I ignore their, like age, their age bands, but they break down, like, exactly what it is that happens, like, in a variety of things. So it's, like, drinking, alcohol, sex, like, whatever you care about. So, like, my son was, like, real sensitive to violence in movies. Mm. And I would sort of forget, like, there's sort of a really, we went to see the first Superman movie, and there's a part where the guy's like, bring out the planet destroyer. And Darius was like, and we're out. And, like, I, like, walked around the movie theater with him. Like, we didn't think it would be too scary, but we were wrong.
Right.
But I would like, read, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, he'd be fine with that. Or, oh, no, he would not. So I would just say,
my thing is, like, I remember really loving it, but it's a lot of talk.
It's a lot of talk.
It's talky. It's a talky movie.
Yeah, for sure. But it's a princess and a very handsome man.
And a pirate and a cliff.
Yeah, sure.
Yesterday, so she says to me yesterday, she watched Mulan 2 twice in one day.
Oh, yeah. I remember those years.
And if you've read Mulan 2, if you've watched Mulan 2, you know that Mulan 2 is basically a romance novel. Like, it begins, I'm not kidding, there's no plot except Mulan and Li Shen are getting married. He proposes right at the very start. And then, like, the whole time, then they have to bring these three brides to be married in another kingdom for, like, you know, kingdom reasons. And those three brides, like, during the journey, those three brides fall in love with, like, other members of the army. And Mulan and her fiance have a, like, break, like, have, like, a, they have conflict, breakup conflict, affected by Eddie Murphy as a dragon. And then at the end, they realize, like, it's all gone. Like, they actually don't have conflict and they're in love. And then they get married. They kiss and get married. And Victoria, oh, and my daughter said, she came into my office and she was like, Mom, will you watch Mulan 2 with me? And I was like, sure. And then it came out that she had asked Eric to watch Mulan 2 with her, like, four hours earlier. So she watched it both times and she was like, I don't really like kissing, but I like it when they get married. And I was like, okay, fine. And then yesterday we were talking and I said, well, do you want kissing in the movie? Because we usually watch a movie on Fridays.
Yeah.
And she said, I said, do you want kissing in the movies? And she said, no. And then she looked at me and she said, well, maybe a little.
Yes.
And I was like, maybe a lot, I think you mean.
That's awesome.
So recommend me great kissing movies for a 6.5 to 7-year-old who's pretty cool with whatever.
Those were dark days, the animated, the, like, rewatching.
There are more now for us than there were for you.
Yeah. Well, he went through a phase where he was, like, real obsessed with Alvin and the Chipmunks. I swear to God, I saw the movie 50 times, and I was literally, like, every time, I was like, I am earning some big-time mom points, and I'm going to cash those in one day.
That's Tangled in our house, which is fine, because that also is a romance novel. So, works out fine. But yesterday, she told me the story of Sleeping Beauty, and she was like, she gets pricked on the finger, and then she falls asleep, and yada, yada, yada. It's kind of boring. And I went, it is kind of boring. And then she said, but the bad guy in that movie, Maleficent, she said, she's really interesting. And I was like, oh, yeah, we're doing it.
We're doing it. It's like those moments of parenting where you're like, I feel okay about it.
I don't. I mean, does it make me a good mom that she's into Maleficent, who's like pretty evil as far as evil goes on the evil scale?
She's an interesting character, and that's what counts.
She really is. She's much more interesting than yada yada yada.
Sleeping Beauty literally just fucking sleeps.
Where did she learn yada yada yada? Has she been watching Seinfeld? Like what? I don't understand. It's so funny.
All right, we'll be back next time with the Kingdom of Dreams.
Bye, everyone.
Hi, Jen and Sarah. This is Morgan in the Pacific Northwest. I'm calling in to talk about a book that blooded me. So I started reading romance back in high school when I raided my mom's bookshelf and read a lot of Jude Devereaux, Black Lion included. I took a little bit of a break in college except for the whole series of Outlander. And once I was out of college, I started getting back into romance and did that through Highlander historicals, and one of the first ones I picked up was Never Seduce a Scot by Maya Banks. This is just the sweetest book. I have a very long list of bookmarked scenes and moments that I love to go back to, but it's basically an arranged marriage amongst two rival clans. It's a little bit of enemies to lovers, and Eveline, the heroine, is perceived as touched, so she's mute, and sometimes she's engaged, and sometimes she's totally aloof. And it's later revealed that Eveline is deaf, and she can read lips. And from my perspective, it was handled really well. In the end, Maya Banks says her husband actually has a hearing condition, and that's how she based Eveline's condition off of. But what I really liked and kind of set the foundation for a story element that I really like even now is that her secret is revealed pretty early on, and it's not a part of the climax, you know. And so once the secret is revealed, Eveline and Graham can move on together and battle some external conflicts. So that became a itch that I like to be scratched now. But it is a wonderful book, and I would highly recommend it. Thanks so much for all you do. Really enjoy the podcast. Thanks.